Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. So now we have Nick Koch, who wants to do a reading about the Ludlow Massacre, which happened, about 101 years ago?
100 years ago.
100, exactly.
Okay. April 20th, 1914, the 12-month strike by the coal miners on the eastern part of Colorado, just south of Pueblo, Colorado, where the steel mills for the Colorado Fuel and Iron, or CF&I, were located, were attacked by the members of the Colorado Militia, which were kind of a voluntary National Guard at that time. We had only gotten a statehood status 1876.
You said we because you're originally from Colorado, correct?
I am. Will always be okay. From Colorado. And so this holds a very special significance to me. This is an article from the Nation magazine dated April 21st, 2014. And they have taken to reprinting information about historical and important world-changing events from our past, because it seems, as many philosophers have noticed, that if we don't make the necessary changes, we are doomed to repeat history again and again and again. And being from Colorado, the last 6 years I spent in a small mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado, which was served by the Denver and Rio Grande Western Narrow Gauge Railroad to carry the pig iron, or coke, as it was known, from the CF&I mines, the Big Mine and the Jokerville Mine in Crested Butte, from the western slope over the Continental Divide to the steel mills in Pueblo, where it was converted using the Bessemer mine process into structural steel and many different kinds of steel products. And so this Ludlow Massacre directly reflects the metals that came out of the big mine in Crested Butte, Colorado, and the men and women and children that lost their lives trying to bring a quality of life that we all seem to enjoy today. But if you ask anyone in Kentucky or southern Illinois, they'll tell you it ain't easy. This is an article called Remembering the Ludlow Massacre by the author Ty Jones. The tents huddled together on the high prairie. For 7 months, they had borne deluge, frost, and blizzard. In that time, occupants, more than 1,000 striking coal miners and their families, had also endured the fear and fact of violence. On April 20th, 1914, the sun rose at 5:20 a.m. It was the 209th daybreak over the tent colony at Ludlow, Colorado. And it was also the last. The next 24 hours, in which roughly a score of people were killed, would be the bloodiest in the entire sanguinary history of the American labor movement. Immortalized as the Ludlow Massacre, its causes and ramifications have been discussed, disputed, and decried for a century. As with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911, or the Haymarket riots in Chicago of 1886, it generated martyrs, villains, monuments, social legislation, and mass movements. For years, the Ludlow Massacre was a touchstone of our radical tradition. Its legacy was fashioned and sustained by some of the brightest publicists of the left, including John Reed, Mother Bloor, Upton Sinclair, Woody Guthrie, George McGovern, and Howard Zinn. Wallace Stegner, the novelist and historian, wrote, "It was a watershed event. Ludlow, he thought, had touched the conscience of a nation, and if it did not make raw corporate gun law impossible, it gave it a bad name. At the very least, it made corporations more careful. The union movement drew enough strength from the events at Ludlow, as well as its defeats and victories on untold shop floors across the country, to force the implementation of new forms of welfare support and working class power. In the 1930s and the 60s, the battle cry, 'Remember Ludlow,' inspired advocates for labor and civil rights. By the 1970s, however, the fatalities in those coal fields in Colorado felt like wounds from a distant past. A massacre fell from political discourse and education curriculums around the United States. And then the world changed back. The gains of labor began to be undone, and the factors that defined the conflict in Colorado are with us once again. Class warfare, corporate monopoly, environmental ruin, the demand for workers' justice, and the influence of media and public opinion. 100 years on, the Ludlow Massacre is a starkly contemporary tragedy." By 8 a.m. on April 20th, mountain breezes were gusting up loose earth around the tents. A clear, mild morning and the ordinary busyness of the community belied an atmosphere of dread that had been lingering for days. Nerves tensed as a squad of Colorado State militiamen rode past the baseball diamond and washing lines into the center of the settlement. The uniformed men demanded to search the camp. Union leaders refused. The military promised to return. Strikers took this as an ultimatum, as proof of a looming attack. After months of strain, the ground suddenly teemed with motion. Terrified noncombatants fled the colony for a protective row of hills to the north and to the west. "Everybody was in a hurry-flurry," recalled the local postmistress, "getting their children out of the way. Union men, shouldering rifles deployed south and east across the flats, hoped to divert the enemy fire away from the tents. On the other side of no man's land, the soldiers prepared for battle. Privates raced to fill sandbags. Leaving headquarters, Lieutenant Carl Linderfelt, the brutal leader of the militia's most feared unit, packed up a machine gun on a mule cart and headed off for the front lines. The battle lasted for hours, but the events of this day stemmed from decades, even eons, of history. 70 million years earlier, verdant organic matter was overtopped by Earth and began the process of coalification. By the 19th century, surveyors in southern Colorado came across an arid territory, devoid of rivers and sparsely treed. The land wasn't well suited for farming, but it abounded with resources. A single 10-mile zone, one engineer reckoned, contained enough coal to power 2,000 locomotives for a century. Thomas Andrews, in Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War, wrote, "Fossil fuels and the energy they contained transformed environments, refashioned everyday life, and deepened divisions of wealth and status. Coal attracted railroads, steelworks, downtown business districts, and monopoly capital. The Rockefeller family, the John D. Rockefeller family, became majority owners of Colorado Fuel and Iron, the largest employer in the state of Colorado. The laborers were particularly diverse. 24 languages were spoken in the coal fields: African Americans, Mexicans, Asians, Britons, Germans, Poles, Italians, Slavs, Swedes, all worked in close proximity. Many sojourned for the short stay and then returned home. Louis Tikas from Crete stayed and became a leader of the United Mine Workers in charge of running affairs at the Ludlow Colony. No one knows who fired first, but by mid-morning it was war. Finding shelter in creek beds, foxholes, and railroad cuts, the strikers sniped at the soldiers with hunting rifles and shotguns. Many of the Union men had combat experience from European conflicts. Maneuvering expertly, they sought to outflank the enemy position. State troopers were fewer at first, with less training and discipline, yet they dominated the battlefield, writes Scott Martell in Blood Passion, The Ludlow Massacre, and the Class War in the American West. The militia might have been outnumbered, but they were not outgunned. Their machine gun fired thousands of rounds over the course of the day. A soldier was shot in the neck and bled out. A striker cried and cried after being hit in the temple. A young man watching the battle had the top half of his skull blown off. An 11-year-old boy hiding in one of the tents fell dead with a bullet lodged in his brain. Wounded men and animals lay twisted across the field. Militia reinforcements arrived throughout the afternoon. The strikers gradually fell back under the heightened assault by hundreds of soldiers. By 7 p.m., the army pushed into Ludlow itself. The first tent began to blister and burn just as the sun was setting. For decades, the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company had practiced every kind of industrial extortion or tyranny. Overpriced company stores, lax safety standards, patriarchal social control, importation of scabs, exacerbation of ethnic rivalries. A coal miner in the district was three times more likely to be killed on the job than the average American laborer. Workers lived in company-owned hovels, which is why, when the work stoppage began, the United Mine Workers provided families with tents. Near a tiny railroad depot, miles from any town, Ludlow was the largest in a topography of camps that altogether housed more than 10,000 strikers. A variety of grievances drove the workers towards open revolt, but the protest was fundamentally about the right to join a union. In April 1914, John D. Rockefeller Jr. sanctimoniously told Congress that his family's commitment to the open shop, a capitalist euphemism for a non-union workplace, was a great American principle. Labor organizers believed the right to be protected and sustained by a union was worth dying for. Their enemies were ready to kill to prevent it. Even before the battle, the Colorado strike was among the deadliest industrial conflicts in the U.S. history. Since its beginning in September of 1913, nearly 20 people had been murdered. Scuffles between workers and the corporation had drawn state militiamen to the coal fields. The soldiers had originally come to preserve the peace, but as the months passed, volunteers were largely replaced by a corps of mine guards, pit bosses, and mercenaries who showed open enmity towards the strikers. Recurrent gunfire inspired many families to entrench. Some dug pits under the floorboards of their tents. Beneath one of the largest structures was a deep bunker meant to serve as a maternity ward for the settlement's pregnant women. As night fell on the 20th, the soldiers rioted amid the flames. The men, a military investigation would find, had passed out of their officers' control, had ceased to be an army and become a mob. They looted dresses and suits, bedding, jewelry, bicycles, silverware. Meanwhile, they had systematically burned the tents, dousing the fabric with coal oil before tossing matches on the pyre. With the fire spreading, women and children still in the camp fled from shelter to shelter. Many congregated in the bunker, turned into maternity ward. terrified of the marauding militia. They remained even as the tent above them became engulfed in flames. They coughed in the smoke, and their prayers quickened as the fire extracted oxygen from their hiding place, and the floorboards above them grew too hot to touch. During the strike months, no one had done more than Tikas, the union leader, to forestall violence. He was a power for good, acquaintances would recall, a very quiet man, working to secure amity until the first gunshots made peace impossible. He had spent the entire day of the battle rushing between the tents, shepherding dozens to safety. When the soldiers arrived in the evening, Tikas asked permission to continue searching for survivors. In response, Lieutenant Linderfelt smashed his Springfield rifle over the unarmed man's skull so hard that he separated the stock from the barrel. His soldiers then murdered the Union leader by putting 3 shots into his back and leaving him as he fell, face down in the sand. 3 days would pass before the soldiers allowed Tikas' body to be removed for interment. On April 21st, the morning after the battle, the sun rose over a scene of desolation. Smoke curled into the sky above a debris-filled ruin. Canvas and wood had burned away, leaving behind racked iron bedsteads and cook stoves. Whiskey bottles littered the ground. Militiamen torched any structures that remained intact, refusing access to the Red Cross and firing without warning on passerby. It was almost midday when rescue workers finally searched the maternity ward. Beneath the charred remains of the tent, they discovered the bodies of 2 young mothers and their 11 children, all of whom had suffocated. Initial news of a sharp fight between militia and strikers quickly spread across Western newspapers. Within weeks, Americans were speaking of the Ludlow Massacre. From the very first moments, no one doubted the enormity of the horror. The New York Times editorialized, "Worse than the order that sent the Light Brigade into the jaws of death was the order that trained the machine guns of the state militia of Colorado upon the striking workers' camp of Ludlow." Yet even while commentators shaped a narrative of the massacre, miners were already declaring the need for vengeance. A defiant funeral procession for Tikas stretched for miles across the Colorado prairie. The UMW issued a call to arms, rousing more than 1,000 strikers into the field. Workers mounted a miniature revolution, in Upton Sinclair's words, destroying mine property, sacking company towns, and killing as many people as been slain at Ludlow. Their forces were approaching Denver before the U.S. Army arrived to restore power. The outrage ignited protests in major cities across the nation. Demonstrators jammed Union Square in New York City. Socialists took the conflict directly to the richest man on the planet, picketing the Standard Oil building on Lower Broadway. Under the pressure, Rockefeller collapsed and took to his bed. Alexander Berkman wrote in Mother Earth, "This is no time for theorizing, for fine-spun argument and phrases. With machine guns trained upon the strikers, the best answer is dynamite." Disciples soon heeded this injunction. On July 4th, 1914, 3 anarchists died after a bomb they were constructing, almost certainly to assassinate Rockefeller, prematurely detonated in their East Harlem apartment. The Rockefellers would spend years working to efface the tarnish of Ludlow from the family reputation. They financed massive public relations campaign and created new forms of managerial practice, offering workers important concessions, though not the one crucial, of union membership. Such innovations demanded by the nightmare of Colorado would become the hallmarks of the 20th century industrial relations. In 1918, the UMW unveiled a monument to the fallen near the site of the battle. It took only a few decades for the shrine to outlast its milieu. The mining industry abandoned Colorado. Working families were forced to move on. And the granite monolith, positioned 1/2 mile off of Interstate 25, just south of Pueblo, Colorado, remained as one of the few testaments to what had once been a landscape of epic struggle. Dr. Howard Zinn, professor of history at Spelman University, was observing from the vantage point of 1/2 a century later, saw two ways of understanding Ludlow. If it is read narrowly as an incident in the history of the trade union movement in the coal industry, he wrote, then it is an angry splotch in the past, fading rapidly amidst new events. A second, more expansive view, he believed, revealed the true significance of the events of 1914. If it is read as a commentary on the larger question, the relationship of government to corporate power, and of both to movements of social protest, then we are still dealing with the present. The export of manufacturing jobs abroad has produced an undoing of memory. Today, the nation is divided by the kind of severe income disparities not seen since the Gilded Age. And yet the traditions of labor militancy and resistance to corporate ferocity that flowered in the era of heavy industry have been largely forgotten by both workers and employers. But Ludlow is the terminus of capitalism's regressive path, past. If our future is shaped by the further degradation of labor rights, there can only be more massacres and new monuments.
Okay, well, thank you, Nick. You know, it's interesting that there was a little incident in recent times, in Colorado with the steel workers back in 1997 in Pueblo.
That's correct. The steel mill by CF&I had gone through many booms and busts in the era following the Ludlow massacre. And the coal miners that were killed in Ludlow were only simply excavating the coal, the bituminous coal, to be melted, to be smelted into coke, taken to the refinery or taken to the smelter in Pueblo, owned by Colorado Fuel and Iron, to be turned into products that are in many of the buildings that still exist to this very day in the forms of structural steel, rolled steel, steel plates, rods for rebar in concrete, and the smelter in Pueblo, Colorado has gone through probably just about as many rebirths as Governor Jerry Brown of California.
That's a good analogy. Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too. The article touched on this. Bill Gorell, our founder and co-host of the World Labor Hour, has a master's in communications, and he mentioned that this incident at Ludlow and what the article stated about how Rockefeller had to, do all sorts of positive public relations actually was kind of the impetus for the modern public relations advertising industry in this country.
In that small town that I lived in called Crested Butte, Colorado, the big mine was owned by Colorado Fuel and Iron, as was the town up above, about 12 miles up Kepler Pass, and the town of Floresta. And it, too, had a company town. If you lived and were a miner there, I met many of the children who were 14 and 15 years of age in the 1920s that were still alive in the 1980s, and they came from all over Eastern Europe, and they told me many stories of the efforts to try and organize the miners there that were met by just getting the daylights beat out of them by mine guards and thugs and mercenaries, and all of the improvements that were attempted to be made. There was still the company store, and CF&I still collected the rent on your little tiny two-room house all the way through today. And the sad thing is the beneficiaries, the wealthy capitalists now have a new classification that live in those little mining shacks, which are worth over $1 million each in the town of Crested Butte now that it's a luxury ski area in Colorado. And the response was, Nick, you know, like John Krizminich worked at the ski area along with Frank Galowich and Tony Stajahar. Said, it don't take much to work at this ski area. It's just like being a miner. All you need is a strong back and a weak mind. And so I could, being a man who uses my labor to go ahead and produce the income that feeds my family, I understand exactly what these miners and all of the men that I came to meet that were known as the old timers back in the 1980s came had to go through during that time, and a lot of it's still in place to this day. Even right here in Champaign, we've got I don't know how many different temp agencies.
Yes,
and they're working. You get paid $8 an hour to exploit your physical labor to go ahead and work in the manufacturing process.
And one really infamous one here locally, Flexengate, in which we documented a couple years ago about same thing, trying to play ethnic. Differences off amongst the workers, unsafe conditions, low pay,
wage theft.
Yes. Now, no one's getting beat up here locally anyway, but these sort of things still go on. You know, in the lesser developed countries, Colombia, for instance, in the United States, and maybe occasionally, but in Colombia, which is the third largest recipient of U.S. taxpayer dollars for foreign military aid, has one of the worst human rights records as far as murders of union people and organizers. So
the Plan Colombia that they Obama and the Bush campaign, or Bush White House's, sent the billions of dollars they sent to Colombia to help eradicate the FARC. The insurgency that had been going on for close to 30 years. Essentially, it was opposition to power. But they lived mostly, and they controlled the cocaine production.
But the ones who received the money from U.S. taxpayers, you're saying?
Those were the right-wing death squads.
Yeah, they were the ones that controlled the cocaine trade, and yet they were the one. Yeah, it's just amazing how, you know, as much things have changed, a lot of things remain the same, you know. Well, Nick, thank you so much for that reading.
Thank you for the opportunity, David.
I'm really glad we did a little preemption here of the Union Edge. So you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. And I'll stay tuned for the Union Edge. In the meantime, this week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.